I want to hear what everyone has to say. You know, I've been certain, but I want to give it. You ready? Okay. Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We have two items on the agenda. Start with Senate File 149, Senator Senjum.
Thank you very much, Senator Latson, and Chairman Latz, rather, and committee members. I have before you today Senate File 149. Before we get into that, if somebody would move the A2 amendment, I would be appreciative, and that would get the bill in order.
So moved.
Senator Goodwin moves the author's amendment, A2. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
I think so.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. For the record, we do have a quorum present.
Thank you again. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 149 now is amended, is actually, in my view, a pretty simple bill. We'll see what kind of discussion it engenders, but basically it would allow an election judge working at a specific precinct to have knowledge, if he or she wanted that knowledge, to know what the other party affiliations of the other judges were, if in fact there were a party affiliation. And as you probably know, going into being an applicant for an election judge position, you do fill out an application, and on that there is a question which deals with political party preference and or if no preference to indicate that on the application, so that that information is known at least to the person assigning judges. I'm not sure if the head judge knows that, but it is known in an application document. This would suggest that at the precinct on a day of election that a judge could know, if asked, what the preference of other judges might be. And, Mr. Chair, you're going to ask the reason why. Maybe I should just refer to my witness. This was a situation that came up locally, and it seemed to me to warrant some discussion in the form of a bill. So I appreciate if we could maybe hear from my witness, and we can have some conversation.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Is this Bruce Cascobar?
Yes, sir, I am.
Welcome to the committee. Please
Thank
make
you,
sure you sign in before you leave the table.
I will.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I consider it a simple matter of verification of existing statute. As you may be aware, some activities in our polling places require assignment of two election judges for their execution, two of different political affiliation. Currently, at best, the only person at the polling place who knows that political affiliation is the head judge. And so this would allow an ability for other election judges at the polling place to verify that such activities are being properly executed. And I think it's not any more complicated than that.
Was there, Mr. Cascobar, was there a situation where this became a problem? Or was a statute?
Well, first of all, just theoretically, the fact that current statutes cannot be verified seemed like a reasonable thing to be interested in. But actually, there was a bit of history, a story. A friend of mine was an election judge and overheard another election judge say, "Oh, yeah, I forgot. Today I'm a Republican." That seemed a little curious. And so it would be interesting, I think, for folks to be able to actually at least know more than just the head judge who has affiliated in what way.
And under present law, that information is designated as not public information?
As far as I know, it absolutely is correct. It is not public information. In our own efforts to try to verify this, we asked in Rochester if we could get the election judge assignments in the city of Rochester, and we did, and they were very helpful. However, they did not provide the political party affiliation. They told us that was deigned to be unlawful, and in fact, there is statute and Minnesota Supreme Court decision that classifies election judges as Minnesota government employees, and there is other statute that indicates what information about a government employee can be made public, and political party is not in those list of things. And that's reasonable for a real 8-to-5, you know, government employee. What business is it of anybody to know what their political affiliation is? But in the case of election judges, again, you know, because political party affiliation is relevant to some of the assigned activities in the polling place, it seems reasonable to have an exception there. So today, at most, only the head judge knows that affiliation.
Okay. And for the record, could you identify your affiliation that you're testifying for today?
I'm testifying in favor of the legislation.
I mean, do you have an organizational affiliation that brings you here today?
The knowledge that I have to make it of interest to do this is because I am a member of the Republican Party and actually the current chair of Olmsted County.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Champion, you had a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, and thank you to the testifier for being here. And perhaps you touched on this, and it just went over my head. Can you help me understand why it would be important for an election judge to have to disclose if they're a part of a major party or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, it's current practice that election judges are asked, or election judge applicants are asked for their political affiliation. One does not have to supply it. They can indicate that they're of no political affiliation or prefer not to say. However, some activities at the polling place, such as bringing a ballot out to a disabled person outside of the normal polling place so that the disabled person does not have to be troubled to come all the way in, requires the assignment of two election judges to bring that ballot to that person and then have that person vote and then have that ballot brought back into the polling place. And so the assignment of those election judges is supposed to be such that they are of two different political parties, and so that obviously that cannot be done unless you know their political affiliation.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
Is it true that I think I heard you say that the person who assigns the election judges would have this information? Is that right?
For instance, in Rochester, we don't have a county auditor, but so the city has a person that makes those assignments for city polling places. They are made aware of it because it's part of the application that the election judges fill out where party affiliation is requested.
Senator Senjum, just noting that your A2 amendment deleted the Section 2 of the original bill. Was there, maybe you can help us understand some of the background here, did you receive input from other interested parties or organizations that led to your narrowing the bill down? What was the background here?
Mr. Chair and members, when I initially got the bill, this was in it. I'll have to confess I'm not sure how that language got in it. As I read the bill the other day, I realized, for goodness sakes, lines 2.5 and 2.7 I don't even agree with from the standpoint of somebody that refuses to provide the information. I wouldn't want to preclude them personally from being an election judge. So I can't specifically answer your question. Sometimes as these bills get developed, there may be a misunderstanding in communication. It got put in the bill, and as we talked yesterday, I didn't want it in there.
And have you received any input as to whether there is any opposition to your bill as formulated in the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, there was certainly with the initial bill. We'll find out perhaps in a moment or two whether there is remaining. As the original bill was structured, there was concerns from at least in my area, from city people, township people, maybe in some respects county people, relative to the recruitment of judges. And if this information was widely known, then it would perhaps preclude individuals from wanting to be election judges. So we narrowed it, and I would agree with that. We narrowed it to that information being available, if requested, on a very narrow precinct-to-precinct basis. And by the way, once that information is given to anybody, they are, by virtue of, and the Senate Counsel can help me, they are held to confidentiality relative to that information, right within the framework of the election team at the specific precinct. I think that's correct.
Ms. Bonius, is that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sandra, yes, it's, they're within the government entities, so they would be governed by the Data Practices Act as far as remedies and penalties.
So if John Smith wants to know what political affiliation Mary Johnson has and is informed that Mary Johnson is affiliated with X political party, then John Smith is bound to keep that information to himself as well?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yes, that's my reading of it, because they're both government employees, and therefore they can share with one another, but that's it.
And how about sharing around among the rest of the election judge team?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think to the extent the data would be accessible to those other judges, they could share within that framework, but they could not share with anybody who is not authorized to get access to the data.
Okay. And Senator Sandrum, do you know, I guess maybe I'll ask the room at some point too, but have you had any input from the Secretary of State's office?
Mr. Chair, members, no, I've not.
Okay. Any other members of the committee have any questions at this time from... oh, by the way, everyone in the room should turn off their phones. Or at least cause them not to make noise.
That was your reminder.
That was my reminder.
That was a good idea to say.
Want to talk
that
to my wife for me?
Tell her I just announced reminding it. You.
Yeah. Any other questions from members of the committee for Senator Sandrum or Mr. Cascabel? Thank you.
Thank you
is there
much.
Anyone in the room here who would like to be heard testify for or against the bill or to express a position of neutrality? I'm particularly interested, since I had heard some background from Representative of the League of Minnesota Cities and the Secretary of State's office, if there are any concerns or no concerns. Either way, it'd be helpful to know for the public record. Please come forward.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. We did have some concerns with the initial draft of the bill that Senator Sandrum had outlined, and the A2 amendment is drafted in a far more restrictive way, and I think what Senate Counsel said was accurate. The information would be only shared within the election judges at a particular precinct, so we are neutral on the bill at this time.
All right. Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Some parts of the state, maybe in all parts of the state, I don't know, the organization of the elections is a county responsibility, or can it be a municipal, and sometimes a municipal responsibility? And my understanding of the current process is that the counties work very hard to establish a balance of political party affiliation in the membership, that with the information that they have, they're able to already engage in a balance of party membership as election judges. So have the counties indicated in any way that they think this is a problem, or that this is an issue that is a problem being created and then a solution sort of chasing it down?
Senator Sharon, again, the counties, at least through email, they haven't visited me in my office, but and I'm talking largely about, frankly, my own county, But I suspect that would be true of other counties, too. We're initially concerned, as I said earlier, about the impact of the original bill on election judge recruitment, simply because it would seem, and I think that's true, the initial bill would almost make this public information, which, again, I wouldn't want either. Since that time, no. The state laws, and you probably know this, do require that the authority, wherever that is, in our case, the city clerk in Rochester, the county auditor, has to the extent possible, assign judges by political affiliation. And I'm sure they do that. Another comment I had from another local election judge, I'll just offer. And it was one of these, it would be nice if kind of comments. And that was, I was an election judge, and I kind of had a question about a certain process relative to the handling of the votes, actually. And it would have been nice if I could have maybe just bounced that little concern off a fellow like-minded person, he or she, and just kind of tested my thought on that just to find out if they would have equal concerns. As it was, his thought passed and nothing was done. He didn't follow up. But it was one of these, it would be nice to, if I could have, kind of thing, and had a little side conversation about whether or not this was an issue or not. So I would expect if adopted, this would get used rarely, but it would allow those that maybe find themselves in that kind of a position to, if they wanted to identify either as with another Democrat or another Republican on an issue related to election procedure.
Any further questions or any discussion from the committee? Anyone else in the room want to testify? Is there a motion?
So move.
Senator Hall. Senator Hall moves that Senate File 149, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Rules Committee. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. We appreciate your time today.
All right, Senate File 104, Senator Goodwin. Members, we do intend to conclude at the end of the regularly scheduled committee time today. That's at 1:30, so everyone who testifies, please keep in mind that I've got a list here of eleven people that want to testify. So if you would just at least keep your comments focused on the core message, we greatly appreciate it. I know Senator Goodwin appreciates that, too, so we have an opportunity to make some decisions at the conclusion of the hearing. Senator Goodwin, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate File 104 is an issue that's been around the legislature for a while and actually once passed both bodies. The bill was, at that time, vetoed by the governor and instead was process was created through the Department of Labor and Industry to resolve some of the issues. The issues are we have a very good home warranty statute in Minnesota. The trouble is it's not worth a lot. The reason is because when somebody has a home built or say you need a roof repair or you need your roof replaced or you need you put new siding on your house or something like that, this 10-year warranty applies to the work that was done. Doesn't it just have to be on a new house? But what happens when the homeowner goes to try to get repaired the problems that that have been made, that the insurer for the builder comes through with three or four attorneys, contractors' attorneys. The homeowner is lucky to be able to hire an attorney. the insurers and builders drag it out for years. The homeowner ends up paying so much in attorney fees that either they give up end up with a defective home, or they end up paying most of whatever small settlement they get to an attorney. I have worked with many homeowners around the state of Minnesota on this issue for many years, and when I was in the House and now in the Senate. This bill only creates a fair playing field, helps create a fair playing field for the homeowner. And I worked on this for 4 years and didn't know that I actually had the same problem in my own place until after I retired from the House, started looking at all the repairs that were going in on my townhouse association and realized that most of it was water damage and some pretty severe water damage, including to our place. So we got a structural engineer out, and here the roof that was replaced about 4 years earlier was totally defective. They hadn't put ice and water shields in. They'd done just a really terrible job on the roof, and it started rotting out the townhouses. So we got an attorney, and we ended up getting the company had gone out of business. Suburban Exteriors had gone out of business, like so many times happens when builders are shortchanging people, and they end up getting in some legal trouble for doing that. They go out of business and sometimes open up under another name or under another builder's name, and then the homeowner is stuck in that place too. So we got an attorney for to try to get money out of the insurer that he had at the time. We ended up with $50,000 for what ended up to be a $6 million worth of repairs to our townhouses. $50,000 total for a $6 million repair. And there was nothing I could do about it at the time. There's nothing I can do about it now. So this isn't the issue to help me in any way. But consequently, as a result of that, each homeowner had to pay $43,000 in order to get the repairs done that had been caused by this roof. Many of the people in our townhouses had to move out. They were elderly. They didn't have the money to come up with $43,000, even if it was on a loan basis, because they were on a fixed income. And I saw what happened to people that, just like I'd been hearing about from other people for so many years. And I've got people here today that are willing to testify about their own situation. This doesn't happen to just older homes or smaller new homes. It happens to $5 million homes. It happens to $10 million homes. And so often, the builder just refuses to make the changes that need to be made, even though there's a statute that says that they have to do that. So by passing this bill, I think there's a couple of things that'll happen. First of all, the homeowner will have a little more fair advantage to be able to have an attorney pursue this against four or five or six or seven attorneys from the insurance industry and the builders and the subcontractors. That's who they have to fight now. Secondly, I think it'll speed up the process because they won't have any incentive to drag it on for years. In all of the cases that I've heard about and dealt with, all the homeowner wanted was the repair. They weren't looking to make big money off this. All they wanted was the repair. Sometimes the homes were so sick that in one case of a family that lived in Orono, all five of the kids got severe allergies from the mold in the home. And the mold turns to poison oftentimes, and then they have to leave the house. They can't sell it. They can't stay there. And one time, it was a county attorney. His home was a brand new home, got molded, and what happened with him was he got kidney cancer. And when they opened him up, not saying that the kidney cancer was caused by the mold, but when they opened him up, he had mold spots on his kidney, all over his kidney. So this isn't a simple matter. I mean, I think the Builders Association, others will claim that this kind of mediation process through Department of Labor and Industry works, and it's not a problem anymore. And that's absolutely false. There's only 20 cases brought in 3 years to the Department of Labor and Industry. Of those, 9 times the builder didn't comply with the requirements of the mediation. So only three cases got settled that way ever since this process opened, three cases. And there's hundreds and hundreds of cases like this all over the state of Minnesota. So I'm not trying to create an unfair advantage against the builders here. I'm trying to create a fair advantage for the homeowners. In statute currently, we have hundreds, over 300 places in statute where attorney fees are given to one party or the other. And oftentimes it's the one with the least resources, the one that has the least ability to have a fair civil suit or whatever. So that is definitely the case here. The homeowner is the one that has the least advantage in this case. Now, I'd like to bring up some folks that are involved in this situation right now and hear what they have to say. So I think first on the agenda is Nancy Johnson. Nancy is a constituent in the district I represent, and she's the first one that brought me this issue in 2002 or 2003.
Yep, it
Johnson,
was in.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It was 2003 that I started working with Barb, and you probably and have been visiting in the past with some of you who have been listening to this story for a long time. When Senator Goodwin and I started talking about this with my husband and our attorney, it quickly became apparent that there were a lot of people who had even worse situations than we did, my husband and I. And as this gained more, as we got more press, homeowners came from all across the state of Minnesota. And it didn't take long to realize that this problem was so much bigger than just the issues we were talking about at that time. And it evolved into something that was unbelievably sad. And what we started doing was we did an email list. And so we organized this email list, and we needed to give ourselves a name, so we called it Minnesota Home Watch. We had homeowners from, as I said, from all across the state. We had attorneys. We had housing inspectors. We had engineers, just a whole variety of people. I'm sure there were probably over 1,000 people that were getting these emails and sending them on to people. In 2009, there were six bills that received bipartisan support in the legislature, in the House and the Senate, and everybody was ecstatic. We were so excited that all of this work would culminate in something that was going to help homeowners across the state. And when the bills were presented to Governor Pawlenty, he vetoed all but one of them. And I cannot tell you the emails that came back when that announcement was made through our list. I can't tell you how people reacted, the people that were hoping to get some relief, especially for attorney fees, and had been spending tens of thousands of dollars on their own homes, and now the door was shut. They knew they were going to have to pay for all these costs. And it doesn't matter if you have a home that's $60,000 in, you know, somewhere in Minnesota, or a home that's $10 million. It didn't matter what the cost was. That was the one thing about this issue, construction defects. It just crossed every single economic, gender, and it was just unbelievable. And so after the defeat of those bills, except for that one, as Senator Goodwin indicated, there was an alternative dispute resolution that was brought forward in a bill. And I think for many of the homeowners, we felt that it was probably not going to work, and it was not going to be of value because it was just going to delay the time again. It was going to cost more money. And when you're a homeowner and you have to foot these bills, you have to pay for all the specialists, all the attorney fees, then you have to pay if you need to relocate your family. You have to pay. I mean, the stress alone is unbelievable. And families are torn apart. Children have health issues like you just can't even imagine. And it just crosses everything in your life. And so anyway, we're really happy right now that this bill is coming back, and that I think the attorney fee bill is essential. It balances the playing field, and I think we need to do that. We need to balance this playing field, and the only way to do that is for homeowners to get attorney fees, because it will move the process. Our issues are with the insurance industry, because they're the ones covering all the costs for the builders. They're the ones paying for the attorneys for the builders. And if you've ever sat in a litigation where you as a homeowner have had to pay for part of the costs of a deposition, and you have five attorneys from every contractor and sub sitting there, and you know how much you're paying an hour for those depositions, plus the attorney fees, it can bankrupt people. And it doesn't end when your house gets fixed. You know, even if you end up settling for a remote sum of money, something that's even half of what it will cost you, it doesn't end there, because for some people, they can't put their families together again. And for others, maybe they can get through it. Maybe they have the financial resources. But if we have a home warranty bill, we should be able to have attorney fees also to help us, because we're the ones having to try to defend that warranty. So I would ask for your support on the bill, and I hope that it flies through the Senate. There's a lot of stories out there. It hasn't changed. There's still the same number of companies out there working with individuals, with homeowners. And I think this is probably going to be the best bill that could get passed for homeowners right now. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Johnson? Thank you for your testimony. Be sure to sign on the witness form as well. Senator Goodwin?
Oh, Mr. Chair and members, actually, Ms. Johnson didn't tell her own story, but they had a bad roof put on, and they ended up 6 months later with a contaminated house with a lot of mold in it. They had to move into an extended stay motel for 8 months. They had a daughter in high school at the time. The cost ended up to be over $300,000 for repairs for a $200,000 home. So you can see the kind of damages that can be done when there is faulty construction. And next on the list is Patrick O'Halloran.
Mr. O'Halloran, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairman Latz, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Lee O'Halloran. I'm an attorney in private practice. Most of my practice is construction, and I'd say about half of that is on residential defect claims on behalf of homeowners. I'm here just because I think there are a lot of people who are in the position of the homeowners who were able to come today, who couldn't come today for various reasons. Some of them have other obligations in their life and can't make it. Some of them have confidentiality agreements that they signed as part of their settlements, and they can't come tell their story to you. And so I just want to let you know that there are a lot of people. This is a problem that persists today, and it's really about fairness. It's about sticking up for the little guy. As Senator Goodwin and Ms. Johnson both mentioned, this is a situation where we have very good laws in favor of homeownership in this state. We believe in supporting homeowners as part of public policy in Minnesota. It's the American dream, right? And we've had, since at least the late 70s, we've had Chapter 327A to provide very good warranties, and since the early 80s, that was extended to home improvement contractors. So whether you have a new home or whether you have a significant remodel, you have good warranties in Minnesota. You have a one-year warranty from Freedom from Construction Defects. So if your builder violates the building code, you have a warranty that you can rely on to get that fixed. If there's problems with your electrical, mechanical systems, that's a two-year warranty. And then there's a 10-year warranty from major construction defects. So if you have a big problem in your home, the fact that it takes a while to develop, you still have that warranty to rely upon. But this is not like what you would think about when you hear the word warranty. It's not like your car warranty, where you can take your new car to the dealership and say, hey, something's not working, and they come and they fix it, and they give you a nice invoice that says zero on the bottom and send you on your way. When you have a warranty problem under the statute, and the builder will not answer you, your really only recourse is to go through the court system or sometimes through a contractually required arbitration. And you're going to need to hire attorneys. You're going to need to hire, maybe even more than that, you're going to need to hire engineers or forensic architects to prove your case. And as a homeowner, when you do that, you're going to foot the bill for all that litigation and all those experts. But it's not a level playing field, because if you are a licensed builder in the state of Minnesota, you're required to have liability insurance. And if that liability insurance is arguably triggered by a claim, that insurer will hire a lawyer, and that insurer will pay for the lawyer. That insurer will pay for the builder's lawyer and pay for the builder's experts. So there will be, as people have said, an army of people sitting around a table. This is not a slam dunk, easy piece of litigation. These become complex commercial lawsuits with contractors, subcontractors, suppliers, and all sorts of legal issues need to be addressed in almost every case. And so they can be long and protracted pieces of litigation. And all the while, those who are getting their bills paid by insurance company are aware that the homeowner does not have that ability. The homeowner has to dip into their college funds for their kids, dip into their 401ks, and do whatever it takes to try and keep this case alive so they can get to a place where somebody will hear their story and settle and reach a settlement with them. And that's what we're talking about here. If there is a possibility of the recovery of attorney's fees for a homeowner, then those on the other side can't simply sit by and wait for the passage of time to sort of knuckle under the little guy here so that they have to either give up or take pennies on the dollar. All I'm saying is that this is a warranty that is a good right to be proud of, and we should let people have the tools they need to enforce it. I think I can stop there, other than to simply add what Nancy had mentioned to before. I believe part of the materials that were handed out was the Department of Labor and Industry's report to this committee back in February of last year. And if you read that report, you'll see that even the person charged with this early neutral evaluation process that was put into place a few years ago says that most people don't get a benefit from this process, and it appears that nearly half the time the builder refuses to participate. And the reasons they refuse to participate is because the builder doesn't want to go through another process and spend money for a neutral and waste time. And so some of them simply refuse to participate, and there's no benefit to the homeowner from that process other than it's another delay and another hoop to jump through. This hasn't solved the problem. This problem persists, as some of the people who are here to talk about their own stories will tell you.
Any questions for Mr. Leo Haller? Senator Sharon.
Under the current law, the participation in this process with HWDRP, I think it's called, is voluntary?
Essentially, yes. I can thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair, and Senator Sharon. The way this, the way that it works under the current law is, if you discover a problem, you have to give notice to your builder. And once you do that, that triggers a certain process. The builder has what's called the notice and opportunity to repair. So the builder can come out within a period of time and inspect your home and then offer you a written repair. And if you don't agree with the builder about that repair, then you have the opportunity to go in to this early neutral evaluation, what they call the HWDRP process. If you don't, as a homeowner, go through that process, and the builder wants to go through that process, then if you refuse, then you have essentially a waiting period. You have to wait a certain amount of time. I think it's, I forget the number of time, amount of time, but you have to wait. It is voluntary, and I believe the result of that is non-binding. The idea was if you can get people in a room and agree early on how to fix these problems, they'll reach a settlement much more frequently, but that hasn't been the case.
And may I ask another question? Have you considered, as you've talked about the problems that are being described here, requiring this participation of the parties, that it be an arbitrated settlement, which would be binding, and that or making the process of a mediated settlement, I think you got to arbitrate it so that it is a binding settlement, and if people refuse to that under those, if especially if the construction industry refuses to participate in that, then they would be obligated to pay the attorney's fees. The concern I have is that if you would add that element to it, and that the cost of that process is shared between parties, that it motivates everybody to get to the table and come up with a solution on this first front end, which right now I understand to be voluntary and can be costly, but not really move anybody anywhere. And you can end up going in the court to court again in the end anyway if anybody's not happy with the outcome. So my essential question is, why not turn it into a required arbitration that is binding and that the costs are shared between the parties so everybody's motivated to get to the essential problem and create a solution?
Mr. Chair, Senator
Mr. Leo Haller.
I'm not aware of anyone talking about that as a solution. I can give you my opinion as somebody who's seen a lot of these cases. I don't think it would be effective. I think right now what happens is you have a situation where people have an incentive to draw things out and delay them. If what you're saying is if we will now force everyone into a particular form of arbitration where every home warranty case would have to be handled in a certain process, I don't think I can foresee some problems that would happen coming up with such a system. The costs, I think, would still – I mean, right now the costs are shared of the early neutral evaluation process. The costs of some arbitrated result would be higher, and I think they would be even less – folks would be less interested in that because then they're going to be going in the front end. One of the problems – I've never been a fan of the early neutral evaluation process because I didn't think it would get us there, because usually it takes some time for the experts to get together and figure out what really is behind these issues. And I don't think front-loading a very a required process that would be sort of a very prejudicial to the homeowner not to put all their eggs into that basket if they were required to, it would simply move all the expense and all the energy up very quickly, and I'd hesitate to say. I mean, we'd be creating a very much bigger process and a separate process than exists for enforcement of any other warranty in the state.
I guess that doesn't make. I'm quite not understanding that. I don't think that you would have to eliminate the process that is in law that allows for a period of time for people to work out on a voluntary basis the issues, articulating what the problem is and allowing for the builder to resolve those issues. But when that doesn't work, it's when that doesn't work that the next issue becomes important, and that's where this bill says that if something goes past that and there is litigation that occurs around this civil matters, that the attorney's fees have to be paid for by the company that built the property, correct? So I'm saying to you at that point, where instead of going to court, why not go into arbitration? It's binding, as I understand arbitration correctly, and then you can also require both sides to equally share in the cost of that process. Why are we not doing something like that shares the cost between parties, motivating everybody to create a resolution to the problem?
I think Ms. Johnson has, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I think Ms. Johnson has a comment on that.
Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committees, I think that the arbitration, the process that's put in place in Dolly, and I said this earlier, I think it's just an extra step when you're involved in any litigation like this. And we were required to go into mediation anyway. We spent days and hours and thousands of dollars on mediation before our case could go to court. And so essentially this is going through it twice. And I think it's not a necessary step to go through, even through Dolly. And if I were going through this and this system was set up, I would just prefer to go through mediation as we did and then try and settle there. We all have to bring our experts in. We all have to bring our engineers, everybody that we need to testify in a mediation. And so essentially what we're doing is paying for it twice. And it isn't the builder.
May I just make sure? I may be misunderstanding something. The difference between mediation and arbitration. You're talking about a mediated settlement in this process. I'm talking about arbitration, and I'm operating under an assumption that may be wrong, and that is that if you choose arbitration, the outcome, the people agree to arbitration, that the outcome is as if it went through court, that it is the agreement and you cannot take it to court. And what I'm saying is if that's true, why not do that? And if people refuse to do that, then you can implement, for example, if the contractors do not agree to arbitration, that then this proposal that you have would be implemented.
Senator Sharon, whenever a case gets filed in court, the court rules require that at some point in the process alternative dispute resolution be considered, and the judge will typically talk to the parties or have the parties select some kind of alternative dispute resolution, or ADR. Sometimes it's mediation. Sometimes it's some other stuff, including arbitration. Arbitration can be either binding or non-binding, depending on what the parties are willing to agree to. The system that's in place in current law for the home builder, the home construction issue, is before the lawsuit even gets started, which would be this process as described now by our testifiers. And that, as I understand it, is simply an early neutral mediation. It's not binding in any of the parties, and there's no judge that says you have to show up and at least try something. It's entirely voluntary whether the parties are willing to participate. So, I mean, yeah, you could have a law that said you have to go through arbitration before you get to a lawsuit, but if you've got – it might be another question to have a law that says you don't have a right to a lawsuit. You have no choice but to go into binding arbitration. Then I think you get into constitutional questions about the right to judicial review of disputes.
But so may I clarify? So you could change the law to say that all parties must go into arbitration. They can decide if it's binding or not. And if they refuse to do that, if the contractors refuse to engage in that, then they accept the risk of paying legal fees should they lose the case, correct? Correct?
You probably could pass a law that said if or even with this process that's currently in place, that if the contractor refuses to participate whatsoever and not even go through the mediation process, at that point, the fee shifting components might apply if they end up in a lawsuit. Following that, I think theoretically it could probably be done. You know, this whole area was a subject, as was testified to earlier. There was a homeowner's bill of rights back in 2007, 2008, 2006, somewhere in there. It was the first few years I was in the session. I kind of coordinated the package, and Senator Saltzman was heavily involved. And there was an awful lot of discussion in committee and behind the scenes and trying to find something that could pass and be signed by the governor. And in the end, what we have before us here is what was passed and signed by the governor. I think there was one other bill. I don't even know if this was part of the original package. I think maybe it was something in addition to the original package. So there's been a lot of discussion. What's actually most troubling to me right now is that there's only 20 people, 20 homeowners have sought to use this process, which suggests to me that maybe a lot of homeowners don't know that they have this process available to them. But that's kind of a separate topic I'd be curious to explore. Senator Dietzer.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with you because that kind of surprised me. But then because I did have concerns about this, and I will tell you because I'm working on that section in the 515B based on what Mr. Halloran said before, my community values home ownership, and in the city of Minneapolis, it's all apartments. And so we're trying to figure out why are they just – you know, is it the market? Denver's having the same issue, and so we're trying to figure out why are they just building apartments, and this section in this 515B came up, and so looking at this, and I had concerns that this may go the opposite way, and again, it's all based on if you value home ownership, but then what the testifier, again, if you're the homeowner and you have to pay for the engineers, the architects, and everybody for both processes. And then if you go down that line and the builder can decide not, I mean, maybe, you know, would it be helpful? And I would like to, Charlie Durenberger sent this letter from Dolly. You know, what is keeping people from using it? Is it because you're going to have to pay these costs and fees anyway and the builders aren't going to show up? Or, you know, if we have this process set up, why aren't people using it? And what can be done? I think it would it be helpful to force them to go to mediation and then say builder, if you choose to not go to mediation, then you take the risk of having to pay the attorney's fees. What do you think of that idea?
Mr. Chair, I could maybe respond to that briefly.
Julie O'Halloran.
One of the reasons, if the question, part of your question at least, and part of the chair's question was why aren't people using this process, part of the way that the process is set up right now is it's part of this notice and opportunity to repair. As a builder or as a homeowner, you're required to give written notice or make sure you know that the builder has actual notice of a problem. And they, in response, they can do certain things. And one of the things they do is they respond and they come and try and work something out and come and inspect your home. And if the builder just doesn't respond, the process, I mean, you don't have a way to force them into this process. Your only way to get their attention is through the litigation process. The early neutral evaluation process simply isn't triggered because there is no response from a builder. You don't have a willing partner in any neutral evaluation to begin with. So I think there's a filtering that happens before you got to those 20 homeowners who use the process, and we don't really know why they weren't in the process. But I suspect that, I mean, it may be that some of them, some homeowners, worked it out with a builder. We wouldn't know that. There's no way for us to track that. But my suspicion and the ones I see are people where they ask me what to do, and I advise them. Here's a process that you can go through if the builder responds, and builders many times do not respond, and it simply gets triggered into a litigation because they don't want to wait forever for a resolution.
We have a lot of other people want to testify.
Mr. Chairman,
we've got to jump to that. Senator Newman, as others are coming.
Yeah, very, very quickly. I appreciate that, that we're on a time constraint, so I'll be real quick. I too am surprised at the number of cases that are going through Dolly on early neutral evaluation or ADR. And what that would tell me is that what we ought to do is move towards fixing the ADR process rather than look at something as drastic as what this bill is proposing. I also want to clear up a little bit of a misconception that I've heard a couple of times now where if you're going to go through ADR, be it mediation, arbitration, early neutral evaluation, that you have to pay for the experts twice and that the experts have to show up and testify. And in my experience, that is not accurate. You have to have perhaps an expert witness on your side to present expert opinions. But when it comes to ADR, they don't necessarily have to show up and testify. The rules of evidence are greatly relaxed. And so they could show up and testify by way of a report even. Especially in arbitration, the rules of evidence are relaxed where you wouldn't necessarily have to have the expert witness come in and testify. And that is one of the great expenses in litigation, is having the actual witness come in and testify. So I just wanted to clear up. I think there's a little misconception that we're going to have to pay for these witnesses twice when it ain't necessarily so.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I think we should move on. I just want to say here also that the only changes that have really been put into law in the past few years have been changes that helped the industry, not the homeowner. This, when we started, we talked about the 1 and 2 year warranties for construction defects. That's recent. It used to be the whole 10 years was available for, you know, getting had for warranty coverage. The industry put that in. And the homeowners to submit a problem in writing rather than just calling your builder and saying, this is wrong, will you come over and fix it? That was put in by the industry. Nothing has been really put in this issue of the neutral, these agreements. That was modified by the industry to be really actually not very effective way of doing business. So all I'm saying is when we talk about creating this bill being so substantial and creating unfair conditions, I think it's absolutely the opposite way around. It's the first crack at it that the homeowners have even gotten in this legislature and in the past legislature. So it's time we do something for the homeowner. And with that, I'll call up Ann Iverson. And Julie Moline, you can come up too, and we'll let Ann go first.
Thank you. Ms. Iverson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak to all of you today on behalf of homeowners in Minnesota in regards to this warranty and this law. I can't talk in too much detail about my case because it's still pending. And I don't want to waste all your time because you're not here to judge my case or not. But just to give you a little bit of background, I am born and raised in Minnesota, so is my husband. We were living in New York City for a little over a decade, had a son, and said, let's move back to Minnesota, where all the kids are above average, right? And so we hired a real estate agent. We started looking for a home to buy. We found a beautiful, brand-new home right in the middle of Deep Haven, Minnesota. And we did our due diligence. We had an inspection. We looked into the builder, found out if they were a reputable builder. They had a decent reputation. We looked into the architect that had the home built. And we were reassured through this Minnesota warranty that, God forbid, anything goes major wrong with your house, you're covered. Because we knew that our insurance policy didn't cover a construction defect, which most homeowners' insurance policies, I'm sure all of yours in this room, don't cover a construction defect. So at that point in time, we signed on the dotted line. We bought our first home that we've ever owned, and we moved in. And that was in the spring of 2013. By July of 2013, we woke up to over 5 feet of water in our basement one morning. We were immediately grateful that our two-year-old wasn't down there because he's still not the best swimmer. And we set forth to figure out what is going on with our house. I failed to mention that we do not live on a body of water. We do not live in a creek. We live about 3 blocks from a lake. That's it. And we were the only house in the neighborhood that had any water, and we were also the new house in the neighborhood. So we hired, at the cost, our own cost, we hired an engineering company, and we had them let us know what went wrong. We also notified our builder right away. We said, we have an issue, clearly, can you come out and take a look at it? They came out, they looked at it, and at that point in time, you know, we had no other choice but to get some legal representation. We didn't know how we were going to deal with this. And the builder, they said, I don't know. I don't know how we're going to fix this. There was no recourse for us as the homeowner. So we immediately sat down with our attorney, and they said, well, okay, so this is the situation. You know, the engineering company is letting us know that there are some major construction defects. The law was broken. There are some code violations here. But the bad news is it's going to cost you tens of thousands of dollars to go through this process. They were very honest with us at the beginning. So we brought in some third-party, very reputable construction companies to give us a table of damages. And surprise, the table of damages was about five times what the attorney bills were going to cost. So we've now, at this point in time, I think, made 4 mortgage payments on our first home ever. And we have a multiple six-figure fix just to get our house back to the way it was when we bought it. So I think you can understand my frustration up until this point. And the bottom line is that there are laws that are set in place in the state of Minnesota by everybody in this room. And it's not my duty in the state of Minnesota to pay an attorney to uphold this law. The law was broken, my house was destroyed, and I shouldn't have to pay tens of thousands of dollars to hire an attorney to back up that law. So one other point that I wanted to address was to the point that we were discussing earlier in regards to forced early mediation or this mediation process. I mean, my husband and I are we're pretty easygoing people. I mean, we were willing to, you know, go through all of these different avenues to figure out how can we just simply get our house fixed. That's it. We went through an early mediation process. We sat in a room. We all agreed on a mediator, and nothing happened. We basically sat there for about 8 hours one day, and at the end of the mediation, the mediator came in and said, I apologize. Nothing's going to happen here today. You might as well just go home. That was it, because that's the name of the game. It's not even about the builder. It's about the insurance company and the attorneys that are representing the builder. It's not about the builder. And the name of the game is how little work can that attorney representing the insurance company do and keep pushing the case off and keep pushing the case off at the cost of the homeowner. And the most homeowners in these cases lay down and they're done. And I don't blame any of them. I mean, can you imagine if you buy your first home and then you're faced with liquidating your 401k or your beautiful child's college fund just so you can simply put your house back together? And that's wrong. And that is why this law needs to be changed and this bill needs to be passed. And it's probably not going to help out my family, but I hope that it will help out other families, because it could happen to you, it could happen to your kids, it could happen to your relatives. And it's wrong. It's a dirty little secret in the state of Minnesota. And I, for one, have always been the biggest advocate. Every place that I've lived in Minnesota, this is not something that I'm proud of. So thank you again so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Iverson. Ms. Moline?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Julie Moline. I'm a middle-class homeowner. I purchased a home in Burnsville in 2011 with the intent of remodeling. I'm going to give you a snapshot of my kitchen remodel nightmare. I contracted with a highly recommended general contractor through a purchasing company in April of 2013, 22 months ago. For what was intended to be a two-month-long remodeling project. Our kitchen was entirely demolished down to the first layer of subfloor, approximately 400 square feet. We were a family of three, left without running water to prepare food for 19 months. Our nightmare started when the floor installer improperly installed a porcelain tile floor that needed to be completely redone, stopping our project in its tracks. I did not want to sue anyone. I made every effort to get a repair from the contractors directly. I invited the owners of the purchasing company, the tile company, the installation company to my home to be intimidated, to be told, it's not like it's a $1 million home. There's no customer service. There's no pride in ownership from any of these contractors that I hired, and they came highly recommended. I met repeatedly with all parties involved trying to negotiate a resolution to no avail. No one would take responsibility. I had no choice but to hire an attorney and spend my own money, depleting my 401k and my college savings for my kids to enforce this warranty. The three contractors did not spend their own money defending their work. They each filed insurance claims and moved on to other projects. In the end, I had to endure many months of stress and uncertainty before getting a settlement. We had to pay an attorney and expert fees of tens of thousands of dollars, again depleting college funds and 401k, trying to get a $50,000 project fixed. Our settlement avoided trial, but did not pay enough to even repair our home, much less make us whole. We are currently left to put our own kitchen back together. Although I have accepted the fact that I will never see that money again, I don't want any other homeowner to go through what I did. The current system makes home warranties difficult and expensive to enforce. I am sure there are homeowners who are stuck with their defective projects because they cannot afford to speak up. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Laura Sieberlich, did I pronounce that properly?
I think she was unable to be here, but I am. Unless she is here.
She's out feeding her little baby. Is it all right if I talk to her, please?
Sure.
And you are?
I'm her husband, Eric.
Okay, yeah, sure. Go ahead. And I'm just going to ask you to do 2 minutes at the most.
Yes, sir.
Because we're only halfway through the witness list, and we've got 20 minutes left to consider this bill.
I can be concise. Thank you for allowing me to speak. My wife and I purchased a home in June of 2012 in Roseville, new construction. We immediately saw that there were construction defects, some things that didn't meet code, and the city inspector did as best they could, but they can't catch everything. So those code violations sometimes squeak by, and after the fact, it's hard to make sure that those are met. We have the floor in our kitchen is sloped to the point where you can look at our refrigerator and it's tilted and you wonder why, and it's because construction defects, shoring posts were set at the wrong height, a lot of defects in our house. We have ice on the inside of our basement. Anyway, fast forward to 2014, we still have those problems. We let the builder know, a national builder, developments all over the Twin Cities, and they still have not been addressed. They addressed some things. They didn't address this. We had to file, get it into the legal system so that the warranty did not run out, and we ended up filing for arbitration, which was required in the contract that we signed. We went to mediation in November. Mediation was supposed to be a quick thing. We're still mediating. We're into about $25,000 of legal costs. We just put a big down payment on a house. I have three kids now. You can't really plan to have $30,000 in legal costs just set aside when you purchase a house. You don't really account for that. Our feeling is that they just keep drawing it out because they have a war chest. We have our kids' college funds, or we used to. There's really nothing that makes them say, hey, let's get this taken care of. They can bleed us dry, and then what do we do? We have to do the best we can to try and maybe take a poor settlement or go to arbitration and borrow money from someone. I don't know how, but it really puts the homeowner at a disadvantage when we didn't get the product that they said that they would build for us, and we really have no way to hold them to providing that for us right now. So that's it in a nutshell. My wife probably could have said it better, but thank you for your time.
I understand. Thank you. Could you be sure to sign in as a witness as well?
Yes, sir.
Senator Goodwin, next I have on the witness list is a representative of the Minnesota Association of Exterior Specialists, Lisa Frenette.
Do
you have anyone else?
Just one quick. Just
real fast. It's your
real
bill,
quick.
But we got 17 minutes to go.
Okay.
I wanted to bring another witness up first.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, Senator Goodwin, I will tell you, if we don't have time to hear all the people that have concerns about your bill, we're not going to take any action on the bill today.
Okay,
I can't guarantee we'll have time in this session to bring it back.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I just want to note that five of the people that are coming are under the same association, and so maybe they could get their testimony out with just a couple people rather than so many.
Well, Senator Goodman, we've allowed homeowners to have 5 separate witnesses making their presentation. So
they're not lobbyists, though, Mr. Chair.
Well, but everyone gets a fair chance to be heard in this.
Okay, we'll skip our last one.
Your choice. We just spent 2 minutes debating who's going to be the next witness now.
Okay.
So, Ms. Frenette, would you like to come make your presentation? You're welcome to the witness table. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Goodwin, my name is Lisa Frenette. I represent the Minnesota Association of Exterior Specialists. We do roofing, siding, windows, et cetera, anything on the outside. I was going to get up and speak a little bit about the home warranty dispute resolution process because I was intimately involved with it along with a few other people in the room here back when it was promulgated in 2009 after the governor had vetoed the bill. I just want to let you know that the home, it seems from what Charlie Durenberger wrote in his letter, the home warranty dispute resolution process is working the way it should be. He actually states that the home warranty dispute resolution process appears to have been helpful to about half the homeowners who used it by providing a framework for settlement of their home warranty disputes. One thing that I'd like to add before I finish up is that the home warranty dispute resolution process was designed so homeowners and contractors could resolve warranty claims on the front end rather than going to litigation. And I believe that the unintended consequences of the bill could create the incentive for homeowners to litigate, which would then leave them on the hook if they possibly lost their case.
Thank you, Ms. Frenette. Any questions for Ms. Frenette? Thank you. Representatives from the Builders Association of Minnesota. I have four people on the list here. If you'd all like to come up to the table together, that would be most efficient, I think. Remy Stone, Mike Paradise, Rob Moschette, and Chad Compellian. Hope I pronounced those names
Chad
right.
Chad Compellian, and he's not able to make it.
Okay, thank you. Well, please go ahead and have a seat. Be sure to state your name for the record and sign in also after you're done testifying.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Remy Stone. I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota. We're a trade association of 3,000 member businesses. We represent the residential construction industry, and we take this seriously. It is true that for the last 15 years, we've been at the Capitol working through construction defect problems. It is also true that insurance happens to be probably the toughest nut to crack when it comes to resolving these situations. Our industry has suffered over the years in trying to find general liability insurance to cover these defects and allow our members to stay in business. And quite frankly, what I heard today is that homeowners are suffering the same kind of thing on their end when it comes to dealing with construction defect claims. And the issue of home of attorney's fees is here, but it probably doesn't really get to the root cause of what's going on in these disputes. And what this bill does is it creates a one-sided attorney's fees outcome for people without actually solving the underlying problem of who's at the table when things are being negotiated. I do have with me real people. Mr. Chad Compellian, who was not able to join you, is a real builder from Willmar. I have Mike Paradise here, who is a real builder from Rochester. And I also have Rob Moschette with us, who is a real attorney, unlike me, who works on construction defect claims. And with that, I'll just turn it over to these folks who live it every day.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Whichever one of you wants to go first, go ahead.
My name is Mike Paradise. I am a builder from the Rochester area. I'm also the current president of the Builders Association of Minnesota. A couple of points I wanted to make. I'm listening to the testimony, and it sounds like I'm the big bad guy, but I guess I'm here to try to convince you I'm not. A lot of the issues that we talk about are moisture-related issues, and it's important that you know what we've been doing for moisture-related issues. Today, our codes have changed. I personally have sat on advisory committees for both the energy code and the building code since 2005. There's been a lot of changes. Moisture intrusion is a big deal. It's a big deal to us builders, and we've made some incredible changes. As a matter of fact, I'm just back from the International Builders Show, and a large portion of the show had to do with materials that help for moisture intrusion, which created a lot of these issues. Be quite honest with you, we don't see as many of those issues anymore because of that. I'm a builder in the Rochester area. I've been building homes now for about 35 years, and I started when I was about two, I think. But our company, the company I'm with, has built close to 5,000 homes. So we've had a lot of experience in the and it's all residential construction. I sat next to a guy earlier today, and he said, this bill doesn't affect me. I'm a builder, but I don't worry about it. I'm never going to get sued. I could say the same thing up until 2 years ago. almost 5,000 homes in, we got sued. Got sued by a homeowner that didn't bother to send us a letter, a note. There was no opportunity to repair. They sued their neighbor. They sued our company. They sued the developer, and they even sued myself and two other people in the office personally. To date, the other day, we wrote another check for $50,000. We're up to almost $100,000 in attorney fees that came out of our company's pockets. Now, the insurance companies are involved. As a matter of fact, there's probably 12 of them involved right now. But I need to sit here and tell you that it's important to us builders, too. And there were some comments here that we don't care. I've been around almost every builder in Rochester, and that is not the truth. We do care. That's why we participate. If I didn't care, I wouldn't be sitting here. There wouldn't be a Builders Association representing 3,000 members. We do care. We are working on these issues. And it is a real issue to us, these lawsuits, too. And it does cost us money. And do we want to sit down and arbitrate? You bet we do. As a matter of fact, you wouldn't believe how many times I've met around a kitchen table, literally thousands of times, and talked about issues. It's important. The question was brought up earlier about arbitration. I'm also a licensed real estate broker in the state of Minnesota. The current purchase agreements allow for arbitration to be signed up front, binding arbitration. Most of the time, homeowners won't do it. Do you want to know why? It's not because the builder doesn't want to do it. It's because an attorney told them not to do it. So there are a lot of tools in place, and the majority of the builders out there are using them. The majority of the homeowners are also. But if you're going to award attorney fees, how can it only be one-sided? What about us? What about the builders? As a matter of fact, we're the ones that experience time after time after time working with homeowners. Sooner or later, we're going to get sued. I mean, there's a kind of a standing joke out there. You should probably change your company name every couple of years, because sooner or later, you're going to run into somebody that's going to sue you just for the money. So you've got to watch our interests, too, and we represent a huge part of the Rochester economy. Not only do we build a lot of houses, we employ a lot of people. And there is a real care about what's produced out there, and there are some good processes in place. The Notice and Opportunity Repair Bill was a great bill. I heard testimony earlier that they require everything to be in writing. Great idea. I can no longer take a request for service while I'm driving 55 down the road. As a matter of fact, I have to tell them to go back and send it to me in writing, and it will be dealt with. So there's some good foundation to the basis of these ideas, and they do work. And I think there was a comment earlier about not that many claims. I truly think there isn't as many issues out there as we work on our building science and as we change our building codes. And as a matter of fact, our new code went into effect on Saturday, and it changed some of the issues we're dealing with and will help produce better housing stock also. So our industry is committed to producing better product, but I'm here to ask for your help also as a builder that can be subject to the same issues. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Paradise. Why don't we hear from Mr. Moshet, and then we'll see if there are any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Moshet. I'm an attorney. I do a lot of work for representing home builders and subcontractors. And I'm hired by their insurance companies to defend construction defect claims. I've been doing this for at least the last 15 years. Couple of points that I wanted to make. First of all, this bill, which transfers the responsibility for attorney's fees or awards attorney's fees, basically contravenes an entire body of law that's known as the American rule. The general rule is that each party to a dispute bears their own attorney's fees and costs. Sometimes other legislation has been passed to reverse that rule, to award one party attorney's fees, but those statutes are basically statutes that are in the public interest. For instance, various consumer protection laws provide for attorney's fees. Whistleblower acts provide for attorney's fees. Certain statutes are designed where an individual can act as or be represented as an assistant or a special attorney general, who can be awarded attorney's fees in matters affecting the public interest. But if you start taking and messing with that rule and awarding attorney's fees for private disputes, then you're opening the door to a whole different can of worms. And I agree with Mr. Paradise that a bill that would award attorney's fees only to the homeowner, if they're the prevailing party, is fundamentally unfair. You've heard testimony today from various homeowners, anecdotal evidence. I'm sure I don't need to tell you that passing public policy on the basis of anecdotal evidence is a very dangerous thing. But there are other anecdotes that can be brought up that show that the system is working, and that in many cases, failure to settle claims is not the fault of the recalcitrant builder. It's not the fault of the builder's insurer. I'm here to tell you that insurance companies who defend these cases want these cases settled, taken care of expeditiously as possible. They don't want to pay attorney's fees either. But there are cases, and in fact, one of the people who wrote letters in behalf of this bill, I was involved in their case. And it was a case where the builder who built the house originally was sued for construction defects, for moisture intrusion, after a tornado came through, destroyed parts of the house, and the homeowners decided to re-side the house with a different product, with stucco rather than the original construction. And the original builder got sued for that. And was there a fight about that? You bet there was a fight about that. And did that fight need to be made? Yes, it did. It needed to be made. And there are many cases that I could say to you where it's the homeowners that are being recalcitrant.
Mr. Machete, I'm going to just ask you, please wrap up. I've got one more testifier who's already...
I will, sir. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the last point is this. There's a problem with the bill in the term, using the term prevailing party. The bill does not define who is the prevailing party or how that is supposed to be determined. There are many cases that go to trial because the scope of the repairs, the cost of the repairs, is at issue. And the homeowner might prevail on the overall question of whether damages are owed, but the builder might prevail on the question of what the scope of the damages and the cost of the damages are. This bill needs more work to define who is the prevailing party. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Coyle.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Goodwin, good afternoon. I represent the Twin Cities Builders Association. I want to just address one topic that hasn't been brought up here today. The last half a dozen of years ago, I have seen the housing industry as we know it change very fundamentally. Hundreds, if not thousands, of home builders are out of business because the market shifted underneath them. And we're still trying to recover from what for us has been close to a depression. In outstate Minnesota, many builders that used to construct homes around the state no longer exist. With all due respect to Senator Goodwin, the proposal that's brought here today, what I would say, worsens a situation that's already very difficult for builders. We've gotten into a very difficult regulatory environment. We have new energy codes that are very expensive to comply with, and this issue will be one more risk factor that builders will have to weigh as to whether or not they stay in the industry. We appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and I'll defer the rest of the time to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Paul.
Thank you.
I don't see any senators jumping at the bit. Senator Hall?
I'm not jumping at the bit, no. I have a couple questions here, if I may. First off, I think the gentleman that's the attorney sitting up at the front there, yes. I thought said it well, that it seems to be which was presented to me as fair and reasonable. When you're giving an advantage, and I appreciate the words here on line 1.11 where the court may award, and so it's not a shell, but may. But if it's good for the one party, why wouldn't it be good for the other? So that's my fairness concern that I have, and probably why I'm not going to vote for this. The other is the definition of prevailing party should be looked at. But I think the overall problem that I'm really sensitive to are the homeowners that don't have insurance to cover this and the builders that do have insurance to cover this. And I'm not sure if I'm understanding this correctly, and I'm not sure why homeowners don't have insurance that covers this. Can
Mr.
somebody
Chair?
Answer that for me?
I can, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Goodwin.
As was stated here earlier, they do have home insurance, but home insurance does not cover construction defects.
I understand that, but then they don't have it, is what I'm saying.
Well, they don't.
So why don't they have it for this?
Well, because
like this?
If you want to require insurance companies that issue home insurance to have to cover construction defects, we'd have to do that by law. They're not going to do it on their own. So, you know, that's definitely a possible fix to it. But, you know, of course, that would increase the insurance rates for all homeowners, most likely. But the insurance industry a few years ago just sent everybody notices that your home is no longer covered for mold. All across the state, the different insurance companies decided that they are no longer going to cover. They just decided that on their own. And that's what happens. That's what
Mr.
happens
Chair.
To homeowners with insurance, too. Senator, and the other thing I want to say,
thank
Mr.
you, Mr. Chair.
Chair.
Senator Goodwin, let Senator Hall respond
All right.
to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that is the, for me, that would be the better way of going. And, yes, it's a fight for doing that because then you have insurance against insurance. But to take a one-sided approach to this, the other option would be take both sides and say either one would be whoever is the prevailing party. Either one, then, would be responsible for the fees or may be awarded those fees.
Senator
That's
Hall,
all where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I think the hardest part about that is you'd never have a homeowner suing over this issue ever because they would never want to take on responsibility or even have the financial wherewithal, except in the rarest of cases, to be able to pay the other side's attorney's fees. Where builders, especially those that have insurance, have at least potentially deeper pockets, not as likely to be put out of business over that. A homeowner would never take on the exposure, I would suspect, no matter how strong they thought their claim was. I think that'd probably be the argument on the other side of that one.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. And the other, Mr. Chair, the other issue here is that the insurance companies have attorneys on staff that they can use. The homeowner doesn't have an attorney on staff. And as we stated earlier, the industry can have as many attorneys involved as they want to, as the subcontractors and so forth want to bring forward.
To that point. Thanks. So what you're telling me, Senator Goodwin, is a builder has attorneys on staff?
No, Mr. Chair, they're insurance company. They have to be insured.
Okay. Insurance company.
Right.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For those of us who have been around, we've heard this issue many times in the legislature. And it's difficult to hear the injuries of certain consumers when they buy a house and expect the house to be a good one. And on the other hand, you also have to consider the plight of the builder as well. And I just bring this up as an example. Most of the issues that we began to see as a result of failed home construction was due to building standards that were created by the legislature, not by the experts in the Department of Administration and the standards and codes. It was us, legislators that were elected, that knew nothing about building standards. They knew nothing about how to keep to wick away the moisture that the new building codes kept in the walls. And that's where the mold issues came up. You probably should wonder, gee, why didn't we ever have mold issues before at such a big scale prior to the year 2000? It's because the 2000 energy code, and it started to really start to trickle in about 1996, 97, kind of there was a conviction on the part of legislators that if a little insulation was good, a lot of insulation is better. And if a little sealing up by vinyl sheets and sealed up with tape so that there is nothing there, then if that's good, then a lot is better. And we began to seal up moisture in walls that were typical of any construction, framing members and insulation and other things, framing members that might have just come off the truck at the lumber yard, but that often contains 13 to 16% moisture content. And then it gets sealed up by other things that go around the framing. And luckily, we've moved that away from the wisdom of legislators. Quite honestly, I think the consumers that got caught in this should sue the legislatures and legislator and not the builder. Keep in mind, the builder was following the law. The builder had government inspectors approve the work. And they did it right because the inspector wouldn't have signed off. They would not have granted the occupancy certificate if that were the case. And yet at the very same time, a few years later, when the mold started to manifest itself, the builders became the target.
Okay. Senator Limmer, I just want to keep an eye on the clock.
I understand,
focus
Mr.
the question
Chair.
Before us
Mr.
As,
Chair,
as an attorney's fee shifting.
My problem is I'm not a judge, and we've heard the horrendous stories of consumers. I'm not a judge. I don't have the benefit of witness. I don't have cross-examination here. I don't have the other side of the story. I don't understand why there wasn't, in the cases of ice barriers on roofs, I don't know why that was not installed in a roof and then approved by a government inspector. I don't have any of that benefit, and I'm asked to fix the problem. And I think this is really a question of, do we change the civil law procedure in the state of Minnesota or do we not? And if we do it, does it benefit one side and not the other? And I certainly want to have a fair court system. I do not want to have one party have an advantage over the other in court when the dispute has not been decided. And so as a result, I'm not sure if this satisfies the civil law procedure of assuring that there's a fair trial when only one side could get compensated, and it becomes an encouragement to sue rather than anything else. I feel for the consumer, though, but I'm not sure if this particular proposal is one that is the fair way to keep our court system as fair as possible as they consider cases, especially when there's an alternative dispute resolution problem that's available.
Senator Limmer, I think the alternative argument would be that the system as it's currently set up is not fair because the homeowners simply don't have the resources in most cases to file a suit in the first place. So they start out at a great disadvantage. You know, maybe at some point there should be a mandatory participation in this alternative dispute resolution process that was established by the legislature in the past. Participation and not necessarily having to abide by any kind of binding arbitration. But I think the question is whether or not the system as it exists now is set up in such a way that it is a level playing field. Senator Sharon.
I think that's right. I agree with that part of the conversation. I think not only in this instance, but in many instances, the capacity of one side to hold out or to drag out depositions or do discovery or all of those kinds of things can break the other side, forcing them to early resolution or destroying the opponent by procedural kinds of things, which are unfair, not just in this instance, but in many instances. I'm troubled by that in the way we have things set up. I just don't know if this is the remedy to that. And at my lack of clarity about that makes it difficult for me to vote for this at this time. I do want to ask, though, what the implications are, saying that the court may award the vendee reasonable attorney fees if there's conditions or terms or, I mean, that leaves it up to the court to determine, I think, it's an assumption that there are, that the court as they watch this proceeding might see that some unwholesome activity has gone on and holding out to resolve issues at the expense of the homeowner and could award attorney's fees, but it doesn't require that the court do that. So I just don't know if that's well enough defined yet to not throw it off too much against the developer or the construction company. So I guess what I'm saying is I get the issue of being caught in with limited resources of not being able to defend yourself. I think we have a system that's created to do that in way too many places. I just don't know if this is the way to address the issue. Could anybody talk to me about this may, the court may, what you think the implications of that kind of language would be in a true application of the court, in the court?
Mr. Chair,
yeah, I guess the answer to that, Senator Sharon, is that without that provision in there, the court does not have the option
right. Of
awarding attorney's fees. So the only way they could award attorney's fees in their discretion would be if the statute authorizes it.
And do we have any history to know how the court deals with this kind of permissive language as it treats people that come before them in a dispute? Do we have any history to know? Do they just rotely give it to, you know?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I'd like to respond to that. The reason that that's written in there is because it should be the judge's or the court's decision, because they're the ones that are looking at all the evidence in a particular case. Every case is different. Every case is different in the way that they're dragged on or not dragged on, or whether or not a homeowner is actually trying to just get a big settlement out of a builder for no good reason. So I think it has to be that the court may, after the court sees and hears all the testimony and so forth, that the court may, if they decide that the homeowner should be eligible for attorney fees because it was the builder's problem or it was dragged out by the insurance industry, let the court make that decision. It doesn't mean that in any case, homeowners are automatically going to get attorney fees. And I think this does help level the playing field.
So would it be helpful to say that the court may award fees if the court determined that the vendor was not negotiating in good faith? You know, that it isn't just a matter of, you know, the prevailing side gets to take the attorney fees. There can be legitimate questions and disputes in these cases that people have the right to defend. But I think the issue is that's being raised in the testimony is that they're using the process to delay and to break the homeowner, and that they can't afford as homeowners without insurance to be able to defend themselves. So if we proceed with that they may award it, I think it has to be restricted and lay it upon the court to make a determination based on what they see through the process, that things were proceeding not in good faith to resolve in the mediated process or the arbitrated process. I just wish there would be something that would be added to that
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with that, and I would be happy to put that in here. I don't know if it should be restricted to just have the court decide whether or not the party was acting in good faith. I don't want that to be the only criteria to judge for legal fees, but maybe there's something similar that Ms. Pontius can come up with that would. I understand what you're saying, Senator Sharon, and if there's a way we could say that would make sure that I already think, just because it says Mia Ward, that it's going to only be awarded when the judge. We got to trust the judicial branch, too, and trust that the judges will come to the appropriate decision based on the facts. And so I'm hoping that's what happens, and I guess that's all we can do. We're not requiring it. We could have said the court shall, but we didn't, for obvious reasons that we've stated here. So if you would feel better with some safer language in there, that would be fine if Ms. Pontius can give us an example of what that might be.
Senator Latz, if I may, I'm not sure that completely resolves the issue for me. I want to go back to this notion that's unclear to me why we can't require an arbitrated agreement. You know, if somebody was talking about that it's in the purchase agreement that any disputes in the contract for building, that any disputes be resolved through arbitration. And if a homeowner doesn't sign that or agree to that and sets themselves up to have to hire an attorney.
Senator Sharon, that's a private party agreement. You and I could agree that if we ever have a dispute, we'll go to binding arbitration. If you don't want to agree to it, I can't force you to.
I understand that, but is there a way to force that, to say that this is the way these kinds of disputes are resolved?
I don't think we can do that constitutionally, because the Constitution does provide that when there are disputes, the judiciary is the venue for resolving those disputes, unless the parties agree.
But we could say that this is the preferred method of resolution, and if the parties don't agree to do that, then why would we... We would encourage them to do that because we aren't going to be paying one or the other's attorney's fees if they don't agree to approach this process.
We could incentivize it. Sure. That I think I'll defer to constitutional counsel, but I would think that would be something we could incentivize.
And Mr. Chairman, under the current law, too, there's kind of steps that you have to go through before you can even get to the court process. Like, you do have to give a notice to the contractor or vendor of the defect, give them a right to inspect and respond. Then depending on what happens there, then you go to this dispute resolution process with Dolly. And if the vendor just, or the builder just kind of sits back, then you can just go right into court. But otherwise, you kind of have to go through those steps under current law to even get into the courtroom.
Maybe I'm not making myself clear. At that very point, why not say, instead
of... I'm going to interrupt, Senator Sharon, because with all due respect, we're 15 minutes after our time. People have scheduled things that they have to get to. If we didn't give people notice that we're going to do this.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
This bill has to go to Commerce, too. So if I'm not going to try to write write new laws right here now, but I will be willing to work with anybody between now and the time it gets a hearing in Commerce. So I would really like to have this committee pass it on to Commerce. They're going to go through it with a fine-tooth comb, too. I can guarantee you that.
Senator Goodwin, I'm sorry I'm interrupt you, but with the question that we're discussing right now is quintessentially a Judiciary Committee question. And I'm not interested in deferring to the Commerce Committee to sort that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would suggest then that come in another bill, because it is not related to this particular bill in that it won't change anything about this particular issue of attorney fees. It will maybe get more people.
I'm going to defer to you. If you want an up or down vote on the bill now, you're entitled to it. We can have that vote. If you want us to lay it on the table, I will indicate that I'm willing to bring it back, given the course of this discussion. We can schedule another half an hour for a final conversation and decisions on the bill at another committee hearing.
Mr. Chair, do you know how soon we could do that?
I can't tell you. We've got budget hearings for the next week and a half or so. We might be able to fit it in during the course of those budget hearings. I'll do my best.
Okay. Then I would like to lay it over for the further discussion.
Okay. Senate file is laid on the table. The Judiciary Committee is adjourned.